Welcome to episode number 35 of the Librarian's Guide to Teaching podcast. I'm Jessica.
And I'm Amanda.
And on today's episode, we are talking about lesson planning and the possibilities for templates and some of the pros and cons of even writing one. But before we get started with our conversation, how are you doing? Anything exciting happening this week?
Two exciting things. One is I finally, after I feel like forever of talking about it, did a live Zoom instruction session.
Yay!
Yay! Except it wasn't great and it wasn't a fail.
Okay.
Like it happened. So it was it's for the honors class. It was a workshop. It was very timed, very like laid out. And it was small. It was six students. So it was a voluntary thing because they're not making it mandatory for students to attend Zoom sessions. Live Zoom session. So it was, you know, voluntary. So six students showed up and they were quiet. None of them had their camera on.
Mm.
So it was a little tough in that sense. And then, like I said, it wasn't a triumph and it wasn't a fail. It just like happened. And I mean, some students provided some feedback. They were talkative, but most of the time it was like I was talking to dead air.
Right.
So that was kind of tough. And then especially because there was two breakout activities and I didn't check. I checked in on them to make sure that they knew what they needed to do, but I didn't like hover and stay in the room and just listen. I literally like just said, okay, you guys, you're good. And I left. So, you know, I mean, I think it was good because the workshop went smoothly. There was no hiccups. There was no tech issues. There was no nothing. Like that, but it wasn't like super amazing, engaging, blah, blah, blah kind of thing.
Yeah. It's so different from the classroom.
Yeah. Yeah. So, definitely. I mean, it's kind of a letdown, but I'm glad it's not a fail. Right. So it's like, it's just there.
Right. And then now they know you. And so hopefully that's a gateway to getting library help. So,
yeah, exactly. Exactly. So my other thing, exciting thing going on is I have my room back. So for the past 6 months, our daughter has been co-sleeping, but like her portable crib has been in our room.
Right.
And we finally transitioned her to her new room and we have our own room back. And it's so weird and exciting. Like we got to turn on the TV, except we haven't watched anything yet. I turned my lights on without having to worry. Like it's exciting. It's exciting to have my personal space back.
Yay. Very.
Yay. So what's going on with you?
Oh, this has been like the week of testing me. Like it has not been a good week. Well, last Thursday, my husband found out that the new job that he was starting this week, he wasn't going to be starting on site. He was going to go to Florida for training.
Florida?
Yes. They told him, they gave him 3 days notice and booked him a flight and a hotel room and said, you have to be in Florida for the next week. And I was like, excuse me, you have a wife with a four-year-old and she's pregnant and there's 14 inches of snow coming. Could this be any worse timing? Like it's just been crazy. So thank God my parents are in the area. They helped us unbury the cars and help me take my son to daycare. And oh man, but it has been something.
Oh man, I'm so jealous. I want a work vacation.
I know, right? Well, he was like, why don't you just like work remotely from Florida and come with me? And I was like, well, no, flying during COVID, I'm already angry at them that they're making you do that. First of all, I don't want to fly during COVID pregnant. Don't want my four-year-old to be flying during COVID. You know, it would just put a damper on the whole quote unquote vacation. And he's working. So like,
right.
You know, we can't go to Disney together. So It's like, forget it. I stayed home. Yeah. Probably better off because it probably would have been even worse traveling with a toddler.
Oh God. Yeah. I haven't done that yet.
No, me neither. So he's coming back Saturday and I'm counting down the minutes because
I'm sure
it's just been a lot. I'm just glad it finally stopped snowing. Jeez, there was like 3 freaking days of snow.
Yeah. Yeah. For those of you who don't know, we live on the East Coast. We live in New York and we got like 30 something inches of snow.
Oh my gosh.
Unreal.
Yeah, so that's that. But, you know, on the flip side, the positive side is that when he goes to bed, I get some alone time, which I usually don't get. Like, obviously, I love being with my husband, but at the same time, you know, I like my alone time too. So I'm beginning to like read books and catch up on articles and stuff like that. So one thing that I read, which I thought about putting as a recommendation, but at the same time, I have a different recommendation. So I wanted to just mention it quick here. It is the first in a series of essays for Project Information Literacy for their provocation series. The title of the article is Lizard People in the Library by Barbara Pfister, who you might know. We had her on last year talking about a Project Information Literacy report. And a lot of the article talks a little bit about, you know, disinformation, misinformation, conspiracy theories. How have we gotten to this point? And so looking back, she's talking about how did we get to this point of like extreme fracture between like reality and fiction with people. And so she says, and I'll just read this quote. She says, quote, there are many reasons for this failure. The low social status of teachers and librarians, the lack of consistent instruction about information and media literacy across the student educational experience. We talk about that, right? The diminishment of the humanities as a core element of general education and the difficulty of keeping up with technological change and digital culture have all played a role. So she talks about four different ways that librarians and educators can kind of start to reflect on these information systems that we engage with and the ways that we can change our work instruction to meet these new challenges that we're facing in our information system, because it really isn't good enough to just teach to the assignment and how to locate and select sources. We really have to take like a bigger bird's eye view with students of these information systems. So I'm gonna dig into her references a little bit because it seemed like there was a lot of great stuff in there also. So I would recommend it to everybody. We've retweeted it from our podcast account. We're going to retweet it from our personal account. So definitely take a look. And I think there's going to be a new essay every 2 months. So keep up with that.
Yeah, I just saw that came out. I'm really excited to read it too. I haven't had a chance to do a deep dive into it, but I totally agree with those reasons for the failure. You know, I, like you said, we've talked about it before. It's just, it's not a consistent experience for students. It's like you can't teach them something once and then expect it to stick. You have to keep, you have to be mindful and have intention of where you integrate these concepts into curriculum.
Right.
So I'm really excited. And what I really love about this series, from what I know about it, is that it's trying to get the word out about information literacy and digital literacy and media literacy to other audiences besides librarians and educators. It's trying to, you know, bust out of this, you know, bubble and reach a wider, you know, general public kind of population. And I think that's important for them to hear that too, because, you know, then the more interest they have in it, I think the more engaged and, you know, self-aware they'll be about these issues.
Right. And like they talked about in the algorithm report too, right? They said that there were other stakeholders that need to get involved in this conversation, like journalists and other people in higher ed. It can't just be librarians sitting here trying to fix this with one shots, because it's not going to happen. So no. It has to be a community conversation. So I like that this was the one they started with, because it does kind of jumpstart this whole conversation.
Absolutely. So looking forward to the additional essays that are coming down.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get started with our topic for today. So as Jessica talked about, we're talking about lesson planning. You know, we often hear the term instructional design, and some, you know, one point thing that we want to point out is, you know, there is a difference between designing instruction and creating a lesson. To me, instructional design is the process of actually developing the learning object or the learning experience. And the lesson plan is kind of the, it could be two things. It could be the summary of what you're trying to teach, but it could also be the plan. So it's not necessarily the learning object that's used in the instruction. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, definitely. Because you can plan learning objects, but then never put them in a lesson plan.
Right, exactly. So then let's get started with some of our questions about lesson plans. What do you usually, well, I guess the first question should be is, do you use a lesson plan for all of your instruction?
Yes, Technically, yeah, I think I do. I do sometimes just use a PowerPoint, but I don't think I've ever really just gone straight off a PowerPoint. I do like to have a listing of steps of what I'm going to talk about.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I pretty much do the same. I mean, I'll talk about it a little later in our next question, but I did at one point use a template. But typically these days, if I'm teaching the same course, I just go off of a PowerPoint and then I kind of outline it that way. So I know that's not a traditional lesson plan. It's more kind of like the outline, honestly, of the actual instruction experience. So it is a little different. So I wouldn't say that I use a traditional lesson plan for everything that I teach.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Sometimes it is just an outline.
Yeah. So, but let's talk about templates. What do you include in yours and why?
Right. So since I do all one shots, I don't include a lot in my lessons. You know, I'm not writing units where lessons are connecting to each other or anything like that. I do have my undergraduate in elementary education, and the templates we used in that program were so long, and I didn't find that all of that info was necessary as I transitioned into libraries and doing one shots. So I start with the learning objectives, because obviously that guides the discussion and the activities for the session. I do like to have those there, because if I'm going to use it for one class and then maybe wait 3 months and use it again, I like to have that reminder on the page, even if I'm not using them in the class. Then I like to list out the activities so that they clearly connect to the objectives, so I can actually see them next to each other. And then I connect the objectives and the activities to specific ACRL frames. So I kind of have my three connected parts at the top of the page. And then I'll include steps that actually move the discussion along. So if I make a PowerPoint, I'll list out what each slide is going to accomplish. So kind of looking at that bulleted list, I at least know where I'm going. Mm-hmm. And there's a libguide that we're going to include in the show notes from stonehill.edu. And I would say that my templates look the most like theirs. And I think I already mentioned in a past episode, but I use an instruction checklist to kind of help me design my lessons, but that's kind of more where like the instructional design comes in, right? Like it's where I include the ideas for accessibility and universal design. And then I keep those in mind while creating the lesson rather than like steps themselves. So I don't really have a separate section for accessibility or universal design. I'm just using the checklist to keep me on track to make sure that the lesson itself is accessible.
Right. Yeah, I have limited experience with formal lesson planning, but you know, it's always fascinated me. When I was a reference instruction librarian, the information literacy coordinator at the time created this template lesson that included some of these things, you know, typical things like the course name, the course learning objectives, a description of the assignment, the IL learning objectives. So notice the two things were different, the course mm-hmm. learning objectives and the IL learning objectives.
Right.
Also the assessment tool that we were going to use, and then a brief summary of how the actual lesson went. We had to submit this for every class that we taught. So in theory, the way it was supposed to work was you fill out half to prepare, and then the second half you would fill out to describe how it went and how the assessment went and if the learning objectives were met. I love this because it kept me focused and organized, but the plans really, really never took off in my library. You know, a lot of my colleagues felt like it was tedious because we had a set of classes that we would teach and the assignments were standardized. So they felt like it was just busy work. And that not much would change over time. Eventually, this evolved into our tracking form that I developed for instruction, which I guess in a way could be seen as a sort of a lesson plan if people took the time to look at the summary. So just a backtrack, I think I might've mentioned it before, but whenever a librarian at Berkeley, as long as I've been the director at least, would submit, they would have to submit what they did for, you know, supporting a class. And a lot of that, you know, a lot of them saw it as just submitting what they did. But to me, I used it more as reflective to see what, you know, how things went. I use that a lot in performance reviews to talk about like their experiences and what classes they supported and the learning, you know, created things that they created. So to me, it was, I used it as a director differently than our other colleagues at the time used it. So, you know, it's a little different than a formal lesson plan, but like I tried to digitize things and move away from this, you know, Microsoft Word template that we were using. What I did find myself using these lesson plan templates for was in workshops when I was trying to teach my people new things. So like I had an assessment workshop, active learning workshop, an online learning workshop, and I used that template because most of the times the activity would have them focus on one lesson. And as a way to kind of get them to organize their ideas, I used a lesson planning template.
Right.
So that was very helpful. Another experience that I had is creating what I call workflows. So they're pretty much similar to facilitator guides for librarians. So we have a set of standardized classes that we support every semester. And one of the ones that we have that's many, many different parts because it's a year-long project is our honors program. This is where this kind of came out of. And I wanted librarians to know what the expectation was to become an honors librarian. So I created this facilitator guide that basically explained every single thing that they had to do to support that class. Now that was like really involved. Whereas if it's for a one shot, it's a little more concise where it says, okay, you know, this is a learning objective. This is a learning object. How do you use the learning object? Here's the assessment tool, how to use the assessment tool. So right. I was using it in that capacity for librarians who might have never taught a particular class before. And I said, okay, review this workflow for this class. I know you've never supported it. Take a look at it. If it makes sense, go with it. If not, we can talk about it a little further. You know, they learned everything that they needed to know how to support that class prior to supporting the class. You know, there are many lesson planning elements in the workflow, and I will link to both of these templates in the show notes.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like the idea of having the, like the reminder at the end of the lesson plan to like go back and reflect on it. I mean, I have a different workflow of how I track the fact that I'm going to go back and reflect it. But I like that idea of kind of keeping that at the end. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. So how do you avoid making it a script? I know that's something that people could fall into.
Yeah. Because if you're writing out every single step, you might be tempted to, you know, write out even what you're going to say. Because I used to write out everything that I thought I was going to say, because I felt it would make sure that I wouldn't miss any tips or points, especially when we only get one class with them. But for a class that's over an hour, I had like 3 pages of notes and lose my train of thought and wouldn't be able to find my place. So that really helped me to break that habit. You know, and I've talked about it before, how like my biggest struggle with teaching sometimes is staying on point in front of all the people, right? Like the performative part of it, even if I know what I'm talking about, can be the hard part for me. So, but having that happen to me a couple of times where like, I have everything written out, so I should be fine, right? No, I can't find my place in the paper. Then I feel even worse because now I'm up there and I don't remember what I'm doing. So, you know, obviously it's not the finest part of my teaching history, but I worked really hard to evolve from there. And like some of that was increasing my confidence and just trying new things until I felt comfortable with these new strategies. So now if I write out a PowerPoint, each slide just acts as a reminder of what to talk about and to guide the conversation. And I think that's what some people just are good at doing from the beginning. And that's cool, but it took me a more evolutionary process to get there. You know, the only thing I do write out now are the steps from one part to the next and the questions that I'm going to ask, because I think questioning obviously is one of the most important parts of our instruction. If you don't ask the right questions, they don't think about the right things. Students aren't reflecting on exactly what we want them to reflect on. So I definitely write out the questions because I don't want to forget those.
Right. Yeah, definitely agree. So in my experience, when I was required to use those lesson plans that I had previously mentioned, you know, we kept it very short and sweet. It was a one-page document that had just six boxes with very specific purposes. It, you know, we didn't provide word for word of what someone should say in their session. To me, the lesson plan's purpose was to confirm that you're staying on track with what you want to teach and accomplish. You know, I will say that when I'm working on a PowerPoint or a tutorial, I do write out what I'm going to say in the notes field. You know, I don't always say word for word, but right, I use it as a guide, kind of like how you already mentioned, how you've evolved. You know, I think if you want to avoid writing out a whole script, you know, use bullet points that will jog your memory to what you want to say, even if it's short phrases that, you know, of what you want to say, that'll just get you to say, okay, oh yeah, that's what I wanted to say. And practice. You know, I do my best practicing in the car. I mean, not these days because I'm not commuting really, but right. You know, I practice. Like, I'll outline it and kind of just look at my outline and say, okay, this is what I want to get across and this is how I want to say it. And then I just practice.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I think that's been, I think everybody struggles with something different with teaching, right? And that has always been my sticking point, is like keeping myself on track with knowing exactly what I want to say. Like, I can design learning objects, I can design activities, but the implementation was always the struggle for me. So it's taken like triumphs and fails right, to get to the point where like now I can lead a Zoom class of breakout rooms and have no script whatsoever. You know, but it takes time to get there for some people.
Absolutely. So, you know, we've kind of talked about our experiences, but we did a little searching. Our different types of templates are out there, and there are a bunch of different ones. So do you want to maybe talk about some of the few that you found, Jessica?
Yeah. So I mentioned this one before, which is like the most basic lesson plan that I saw out there. It's from Stonehill College. And I just love how simple it is. You know, at the top of the page, they have the frames, how long it takes, the learning objects, or the learning objectives and the outcomes. And then it's just a bulleted list of initial discussion, activity, reporting back after the activity, and, you know, research questions that you might want to ask them. So it's really basic. And a lot of these lesson plans, I actually printed a few that I could use in some of my classes. They're really topical and really great. So I like that one because it is just kind of a bulleted list to keep you on track. And the focus should be on the discussion with the students, you know? The other option that's out there are these types that are kind of instructor versus learner templates. And when I was doing my undergrad in elementary education, those were the types of lesson plan templates that we frequently used. And it splits the lesson steps into two columns and it spells out who is doing what at each time. So the teacher does this and then the students do that. And at first I found that really confusing because when I would write something in every single column and row, and it felt really redundant, like instructor explains the activity and student listens. Like, that's how we were taught to do it. And I just found it so unnecessary. Yeah. But in adapting it, I could see how like maybe that side-by-side process could be used if it was made less redundant. So like instructor breaks student into groups, you know, students open Padlet and work with teammates to evaluate an article, right? So those, if you're more of a visual person and you like things in tables rather than bullets, mm-hmm, I could see that being a helpful lesson plan. Otherwise, I find it confusing.
Yeah, I'm all about a good table. I love right, a table. I just, that's how I work. I mean, I do a lot of tables. Like, I've run my life in with tables. Like my shopping list, totally random, but like my shopping list is a template. It's a columns template. things like projects that I want to get done. I have it organized in a template, like a table template, projects around the house, work projects, all in table templates. It's just clean to me. Just that's how I operate. But I love the Stonehill template. I thought that one was super simple, wasn't overwhelming. I really felt like if I had to implement a lesson plan again like that, I'd probably do something like that.
Right. And I felt like, I mean, they were also well written because I feel like I could take that piece of paper into the classroom with nothing else and teach. And to me, that's the sign of a good lesson plan, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I always fantasize that I would do that, that I would stand there with like a lesson plan template and just like go off of it. But like never, ever, ever in 12 years did I ever print out a lesson plan template or an outline. It's just not how I operated. I don't know.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So you also found something more complex from Megan Oakleaf.
Yeah. So I found an example of one of her lesson plans. And I mean, it definitely is comprehensive is the word that I would use. And it seemed similar to a lesson plan template that I used when I took an ACRL workshop. It was like a 6-week workshop on the framework. Maybe, I don't know, 2 or 3 or 4 years ago at this point. And it was similar to what we used. So, you know, she lists out all like what I'll call the demographic information about the class, the materials you need, the preparation, the standards, the questions, like what big picture questions do you want to ask? Then each part of the session, right? So introduction, the teaching strategy one, how are you going to check for comprehension of that first strategy? And then those two repeat back and forth a couple of times. How are you going to wrap up the lesson? How are students going to be assessed? So it's very long. And I found an example of in Project Cora of someone who used that lesson plan or something similar. And it was 28 pages long. And I was just like, what, how do you function with that?
That's crazy.
It was just a lot. I mean, and I do think some of those things are helpful. I think some people might like to really put everything out there about the lesson. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it's a style that certain people might like. So we're definitely bringing it up. But it's definitely a comprehensive, definitely comprehensive lesson plan.
Yeah. What I loved about it is that, you know, it was basically a guide and a learning opportunity for librarians as well. You know, it got them involved. You know, librarians who are getting involved in instruction might not have, you know, the confidence or formal training. And this type of template, will guide them and keep them on track. You know, we talked about this in previous episodes where, you know, we only have one shot with most of us are, you know, we do one shots and we want to teach them everything and we can't. And I think the lesson plan gives us that focus that, no, you should not be teaching everything, you know, stay on track. You know, I think another great use of lesson plans is, simple ones at least, would be to share them with faculty. You know, I think it's a great opportunity for us to, you know, demonstrate to faculty that a lot of work goes into our instruction and that we're not just showing them the library. I also think, you know, it would be beneficial to faculty who want to provide information literacy instruction themselves. You know, they could then just go to wherever you store your files, which we'll talk about in a second. And then they could go there and then download the lesson and then use it themselves. So I think, you know, there's many opportunities to use a lesson plan. There was also one other type that we wanted to mention, which is the sandboxes.
Yeah, a lot of the sandbox websites like Cora and Primo, they didn't use necessarily everybody. I don't think everybody used the same template, but a lot of people use something similar to Megan Oakleaf's. And in that situation, I think it makes a lot of sense. When you're sharing a lesson plan with someone else, it is important to have like the preparation needed, materials like websites or handouts, expanded steps explained. Because when you're sharing that plan, you're teaching someone else how to use that plan. So if you don't include all that information, then they're kind of left having to reinvent that part of the lesson plan. So I think the sandbox templates can be helpful too, because they do include a little bit more information than just kind of bullet points. So that is helpful. And on my team, you know, we just started using a LibGuide to share materials with one another. And I'm realizing how helpful it might be if I included some more information in what I shared there. So I might check back and just make sure that enough information is there as opposed to just a PowerPoint that someone can run with.
Yeah, and I think that that flows nicely into our last part of this discussion is, well, how do you organize your lesson plan files? Where do you store them? How do you share them, et cetera?
Yeah, I've always struggled with keeping my files organized. And it really irks me because I'm such an organized person in general. So it's like, why can't I get this right? I have trouble like remembering what's in each file, especially if I make tweaks depending on the professor. Or if I start with one learning object and tweak it a little bit, then it's like, you know, version 2.0, but what does that mean? Then the file names get too long and I don't want to have to print out like new versions. I don't like having paper copies. And I usually have a lesson plan plus a PowerPoint file plus maybe a worksheet. So, you know, if listeners have foolproof ways that they organize themselves, please DM us or tweet us because we'd love to share that information and also selfishly use it ourselves. What do you
So on the instructor level, I keep my files in a folder and I label them by semester and then by course and by professor. Okay. And so if I am supporting a professor, we typically... When we do instruction, I assign our librarians their standardized courses at least. And we always go based off of previous relationships. So there's many cases where I support the same faculty every semester. So right. My typical workflow is if I'm working with the same professor from last semester or two semesters ago, I confirm that the assignment is the same. And then I copy the PowerPoint and the lesson from the previous semester into the new semester. And then I make my tweaks there. So that's my workflow for individual classes. But as a director, we keep our workflows and our learning objects on a LibGuide that I call the Instructional Services Content Repository. Where this is where I include the workflow documents, the learning objects, the assessment tools. It was a goal of mine just to kind of streamline instruction. And I was very proud of it and super excited that I was able to share that with librarians. It just made it so much easier when I had to reach out to someone and ask them to support a new class because everything was right there for them. We also tried to get an internal sandbox off the ground for faculty, but it was very challenging to get librarians to contribute to the sandbox. And, you know, the project really never took off. But both LibGuides are live, and I will share the link to these in our newsletter. So just a quick plug, if you haven't signed up for our newsletter to get access to these extra LibGuide goodies, check out the pinned tweet on our Twitter page and sign up.
Cool. Sounds good.
Yeah. Yeah. Alrighty, so this is the point in the show where we transition and we share a recommendation, a triumph, or a fail. So what do you have for us this week, Jessica?
Okay, so I have, which is funny enough, related to lesson planning. I recently over the break read the Critical Library Pedagogy Handbook, Volume 2, which is just a book of lesson plans. So the first book is more like the theory and things like that, whereas this is all lesson plans. And it's really interesting. They have, you know, topics about, you know, questioning authority, podcasting as pedagogy is a lesson plan. And actually questioning authority was by our friend Ramel from an earlier episode. Mm-hmm. So you know, what I've always struggled with, and I've mentioned this in previous episodes with CritLib is, you know, I love the ideas and the concepts, but sometimes it's putting it into practice in the classroom into a lesson plan form was like the threshold concept that I struggled with. So having this book to actually see, you know, people that I consider colleagues too, writing these lesson plans and actually putting it into a practical format that I could walk into the classroom with was really helpful. So I would definitely recommend this book, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes.
Yeah, it's been on my to-read list, So hopefully I'll get to it at some point. I'm trying to get through. I've been starting to listen to audiobooks again, and I'm trying to get through City of Girls, and it is like the longest, long-winded audiobook ever. So I'm determined to finish it before it expires because I borrowed it through my public library. So I'm trying to get through that. I haven't even listened to any of my podcasts. It's been like weeks of no podcasts. They're building up. It's crazy. So, but I definitely want to get that to, added to my read list. So yeah. I also have a recommendation. My recommendation is that it's okay to be pandemic fine. So what that means is that you are in good health, and that you are employed, but that you could be, you know, not yourself or depressed or upset. And it's okay because so I have to give credit to, before I talk about it more, to Sarah Smith, who is a reporter at the Houston Chronicle. I saw this on Twitter. Someone that I follow tweeted her tweet about it. And I love it because it's something that I've been trying to describe for a long time now. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't articulate it, you know, because like, I think we might have talked about this a long time ago when the pandemic first really like hit and we were talking about like, it's okay to be upset that things get canceled. Mm-hmm. And this is like how I feel, like it's okay to be upset, even though, you know, you still have a job and you still have your health, like you can still have feelings about other things and not feel guilty about it. Because I feel like, you know, there's been a lot of things that have been going on lately in my life and like on top of the pandemic.
Right, exactly.
That I'm just like, I don't know how to articulate it. And I don't know if it's appropriate to talk about it because we're living through a pandemic, you know? So yeah. My recommendation is that it's okay to be pandemic fine. And it's okay to talk about the things that are bothering you outside of the pandemic. And I hope, you know, more people start to think that way as well, because I think it's important for our mental health.
Yeah, definitely. And I do think we talked about it a little bit in an episode at the beginning of the pandemic about like Brené Brown's concept of like comparing grief. You know, it's like, we're still allowed to be upset about the fact that our lives are normal, even if, you know, someone else loses a family member, right? Like, we're not allowed to compare grief. That doesn't mean that we don't also have empathy, extreme empathy for people who are going through things worse than us. But that like pandemic fine concept hit me a little bit the other day when I was driving my husband to the airport, because it's usually an exciting thing, right? Because like someone's going on a trip and it's fun. But at the same time, it was like, things are not fine. Things are not normal. Like, I would normally want to be on that plane with him and going and doing something fun, but we're not going to be able to do that for a while. And so like, there was a little grief of that, of like, this feels normal, but it's not. And so, you know, I had to be okay with those weird, uncomfortable feelings about that. So yes, I definitely relate to that concept. We're not just fine, we're pandemic fine.
Yeah.
For a little bit longer.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think I've really struggled with the working from home thing. I think it's mm-hmm. really messed with my head. I mean, I used to work from home maybe once every few weeks, so that wasn't new to me, but I miss so much. I miss the social aspect. I miss the getting up and putting professional clothes on and driving.
Yeah,
I even sort of miss my commute a little bit, just a little bit.
Right. You know?
But like, so it's definitely changed me, and it's a little upsetting that, you know, mm-hmm. that's how things have changed. And like, it's also created these new weird expectations that I have, that I should be doing all these things at home that I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
So it's right. definitely changed me. So I'm pandemic fine, but you know, I've got things to,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the productivity thing from working from home has been a positive and a negative. I mean, I already had a major shift after having a child of re-establishing what productivity means. But I think this took it to another level. And like, I had to be okay with not being super productive, because like, A, I'm in my house and I'm distracted. And B, like, hello, there's a global pandemic. The whole world's like exploding. And it's for our mental health. It's okay to not be are pre-pandemic productive. Mm-hmm. And so it was like a second rewiring of productivity for me after the last one a couple of years ago. So, but again, there's a positive and a negative there. You know, it's a little bit of a struggle to push through.
Yeah. So that wraps up another episode of The Librarian's Guide to Teaching. Here's where you can find us. You can find the podcast at librarian_guide. You can find Jessica at librarygeek611. You can find me, Amanda, at historybuff820. And you can always email us at infolitteachingpodcast@gmail.com. Be sure to rate and subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen. We would love to hear from you in the reviews as well.